lifelong Sitkin. My folks were in Port Alexander when I was conceived. And then I was actually born in Anacortes, Washington, because they did not have the facilities in Port Alexander, and then lived here my entire life. And 30 years in the Army. Went to the Academy, went to West Point for my education, and married a beautiful lady from Ketchikan named Debbie Dickinson. We have three wonderful children, six grandkids. And I'm a second-generation Sitkin who, like all people lived here for that period of time, appreciate the value of our special place.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to ask about next is, you know, with people who aren't from here, it's always good to ask what brought you up. For people who grew up here, it's always nice to ask what kept you.
It's in the blood. My wife said, while I was in the Army, she would, you know, go anywhere we had to go, but when it was over, we was going to come back home. And we both felt that way. It's just who we are. It's the mountain. It's the water. It's a small town. It's being in Southeast Alaska. So.
In the time you've lived in Sitka, how have you seen the community change, for better or for worse?
Well, pretty dramatically. When I got here in 92, it was one of the great privileges of my life to be city administrator here for 9 years. I couldn't have asked for a better assignment coming out of the Army. And at that time, we had a pulp mill. And so the pulp mill closed the first year I was in Sitka. And we went through the really difficult processes of retooling our economy and figuring out how we move forward. We actually went through a pretty long process of strategic analysis and focus groups with a mill closure, and it went on for over a year. And when it came out of that, there were three themes that were always prevalent when it came out of what we wanted to do. We wanted to maintain our small-town atmosphere. We wanted to maintain our quality of life. We wanted to have a growing economy. Some people think those are mutually exclusive. I don't. I think you just got to be sure that when you make decisions, they're compatible with all three of those. And so that was a major change to Sitka. The political battles in those days were really difficult, deep. The good news is that some of the partisan ship that was part of our town in those days, I think, to a large degree, has sort of faded away. We're more homogeneous now, although still a very complex and diverse society. So that was the major change in that. As a impact of that change was the impact on our school district. We had about 1,800-plus students, a really robust curriculum, and we do. I've got just had Kiefer Dunn graduate from high school. He's well prepared to go to college, but he was unable to take French his senior year because you've just had to cut back some curriculum over the last, you know, 18 years since the mill closed. I think our attendance is down around 1,200-1,300 now. So that's been a change.
So enrollment's at 1,330-ish, I think. And from 1,800, you said, before the mill closed. I wonder, have you seen the broader economy in Sitka? Has it bounced back from the mill? Because for people who came after the mill closed, it can be hard to understand that maybe there was some sort of economic damage here once upon a time. Where are we in terms of recovery?
First of all, if economies are not growing, then you're going to be in trouble. And sometimes people get a little bit nervous about, you know, in exploiting economy and what it impacts the city. On the other hand, if you don't have an economy that's moving forward and robust, you're not going to be able to do all the things you need to do, like education. So has it recovered? Yes, I think it has. We've got a very diversified economy, healthcare, education, Coast Guard, nonprofits, and other federal agencies. So we've been pretty robust, but I can tell you from one of my children that the reduction in the tourism in the last 2 years is being felt on Main Street. It's being felt in some of the businesses in the community and some of the charter fleet is being adversely affected by that. So my view is we need to have a robust economy so that we can do the important business of taking care of our senior citizens, the business of taking care of our children and getting them educated, taking care of the issues with our society at large, and so forth. So I'd like to also say that, it's, you know, when you talk about our town, besides taking care of our seniors and our children, we've got a very important Native community. When I was a city administrator, we did our first agreement with our tribal agreement with the Sacred Tribe of Alaska, first in the state. They need to be honored, respected, and embraced, and they contribute mightily to our town.
What was that agreement about?
It just recognized them as a tribal government, and was a symbolic gesture that, that we saw how important they are to the community, and we were committed to working with them. So anyway, to go back, and we're always a fishing community. You know, we always have been, and we always will be. My father was started out as a fisherman when he came up here. Wasn't a very good one. Ended up getting in the airline, in the Alaska Coastal Airlines. But in this complex community called Sitka, if we want to do all the things that are important to us, like we're a very artistic community, you know, I'm delighted that the Fine Arts Camp and the Music Festival and Sitka Sound Science Center are able to be on the old Sheldon Jackson campus. But all these things that we embrace in our town cost money. And so I'm clearly committed to aggressive about how can we sustain and improve our economy within the ethos of small-town atmosphere, quality of life, and improving economy. So,
what made you decide to run for office as a writer?
Yeah, why would an old man like me, who enjoys his leisure time, want to do this? Well, the first when I did it, there was only three candidates for three slots, and I just thought it was improper that anything is important as having our assembly members elected, that we not have a choice among our town. So I ran primarily, instinctively, because I wanted to have a choice. But as I thought of it, I also had two other reasons that I wanted to run. The second is I want a more open and supportive city government committed to improving our town and solving problems. And I think we've been short there the last few years. And then thirdly, I want to ensure our budget realistically reflects the community needs, and our citizens have the means to pay for it. Listen, in government, there's an unlimited ability to do good and do good, things that are important. But you always have to balance what government wants to do versus the ability of its citizens to pay for it. Listen, we got a large senior citizen in this town, a lot of them on fixed incomes. And so, you know, $20-$30 a month means something to them. So I just want to be sure that we've done the kind of analytical work that we need to do to be ensure that our budget is properly formed. I hired Jay Sweeney, and Jay Sweeney is a great guy, and he will provide for the assembly and our citizens the kind of detailed information that we need to know on what we have to do to fund city government. I also believe you need to fund city government. I mean, city government has an important role to play. We want to educate our kids. We want to have our recreational facilities. We want to do all those things we want to do. But we got to be sure that we're doing it after ensuring that we've minimized the cost to the citizens. And I look forward to working with fellow assembly members and administration on that issue.
How do you bring those two things into balance? How do you aim high on the things you want to provide to your citizens and at the same time aim in the right direction in terms of how much you can afford to spend on it?
Well, you clearly got to be proactive. We had a five-year process that we evolved largely through the help of Jay Sweeney and Dave Wolf over two or three years, that with all of our enterprise funds and our general fund, we looked out at least 5 years. And we did not do everything perfectly, Ed, but the issue was that we tried to at least be able to anticipate 2 or 3 years ahead of time of when we needed to increase a fund. So we were able to put the information out and then provide good information to the city on why we did it. When I was here, we raised our sales tax from 4% to 5%. And every year for several years, the voters came back to validate that we could keep that, because I said we'd live within that means. And so you live within the means. And that's easier said than done, but you got to make a goal, and then you got to try to stick to it. And again, there's plenty to criticize, I'm sure, when I was city administrator, stuff we did, but we also had a process that any money that was on spent at the end of a year, we put into a capital maintenance fund, and that's how we built the fire hall. We had enough money because city, we always programmed our budget. You know, you were conservative in terms of your revenue, and you maxed what you thought your expenditures would be. And so inevitably, in the course of a year, we always had money left over, a few hundred thousand, sometimes more, sometimes less. Put that in a separate fund to do that. Now, that's not just going to solve how we are now, but you just got to put marks on the wall and then try to get there. One of the two things that I think are most important to maintain at their current rates is property tax and our electrical fund. You know, because everybody, the electrical fund particularly, affects everybody in town. And so people who are most vulnerable may have the most difficult paying for that. Now, having said that, listen, what we're doing in Green and Blue Lake in Hydro is absolutely the right thing. I applaud the administration for their focus on that, and we've got to do that. And if the numbers say that you've got to increase it, that's fine. But I want to just, if I'm on the assembly, I'm committed to working with the administration and the assembly, but I want to go in as a laser and look at all those issues and look out 5 and 10 years and see how the cost numbers are going
to
be.
I want to talk about energy in a second, but I want to get back to one of your reasons for running for office first and just ask you to clarify or to go a little deeper on it. You said you want a more open and supportive city government that we've been lacking there the last couple of years. Explain that. How do you see it lacking in openness and supportiveness?
That's my impression from dealing with the city government, trustee in the Board of Trustees for Sheldon Jackson. I think the city government is not preoccupied, but they focus a great deal on the budget and, you know, not spending money. And so in my view, it's sort of a myopic view of the town, you know. And again, I've done this from a distance. I haven't done it I've not spent a lot of time with people in the administration trying to sort things out, but that my impression is that it's tough to get the city to join in collaborative efforts that would be good for our town and move us forward. And it's more than just about money. It's about committing talent and time to try to solve community problems. And again, we're a very small, diverse, but a complicated town. So that's my impression. And that's, again, easy to say, but it's sort of hard to do. And I'm going in, should I be reelected, with no predisposition. I'm going in to sit with everybody and do the best I can and be sensitive to other people's needs and issues and so forth. But I believe that our city government can be a major player in the whole diverse stuff that goes on in Sitka, Southeast Alaska. So.
Energy. The city is raising the Blue Lake Dam or working toward it, mm-hmm. and encouraging Sitkins to cut back on energy. What are some long-term solutions in your mind to the energy situation here in Sitka?
First of all, I want to say again, I applaud the focus and the effort of our administration and assembly on Blue Lake. That's good. They moved that way forward than I did while I was city administrator, and we probably in retrospect should have been more aggressive in doing that. But they've done that. And after that, you know, TACUS is the end game in the Southeast Intertie. And quite frankly, Ed, I've lost track of where we are in the Southeast Intertie. But strategically, the Southeast Intertie and getting a road up the Lynn Canal are the two things that's going to solve a lot of the problems in Southeast Alaska in terms of transportation, the marine highway system, reasonable cost for energy throughout the region, and so forth. So, and that is a regional state issue that I would look forward as part of city government to work on at the state level. Yeah, we need to sort out our energy issues in Southeast and our transportation issues in Southeast And there's always going to be differences of opinion, you know, but you need to listen to all the information and then come to some conclusions that are best for everybody.
The city assembly, some assembly members have mentioned, the utility director just mentioned at the last meeting that a variable rate structure, that a revamping of the rate structure is being looked at. Is that a viable option, in your opinion, changing the rates?
First of all, electrical department is a critical part of our town, and I think it's been a long time since we've done a rate structure. Yeah, I think that, especially knowing that we may have an issue in terms of cost to our users, that would be absolutely appropriate. I applaud that. I have met, but I've not personally talked with the electrical superintendent. I know he's got a good reputation. Yeah, I think that he is being aggressive in terms of trying to figure out alternatives, and I think that's exactly what we should be doing. And in a variable rate structure is probably is a good thing to look at.
Sorry.
The end game in electrical department,
yeah.
The end game is, you know, I don't know how much I got in the unused reserves now. We used to put $500,000 a year into you got two reserves in the electrical fund. The restricted reserve, which is there by covenant because you have to have the money there if there's a major problem in energy, so you could solve it, about $10 million, I think. In the unrestricted reserve, we used to have $6 or $7 million, and we put $500,000 in there almost every year. I have no idea what's in the unrestricted reserve now, but you got to do the calculus of, you know, what's going to be the debt in 5 years, and what are the funding sources between now and then to see what the range of costs are going to be. That's probably already been done, but I'd be anxious to take a look at just how detailed they've done all that calculus to figure out exactly what the potential costs could be to our users.
I want to ask you about something that came up during our candidate forum last week. People wanted to know about the cost of living in Sitka, everything from general expenses that a household faces to the household itself, and affordable housing and those kinds of things. Is it too expensive to live in Sitka, in your opinion, and what can be done about it if it is?
Of all of our problems that we have here, that's really one of the most difficult ones. Cost of housing in Sitka, even with the economy, national economy the way it is still very, very, very high. And it's limited. We've never overbuilt, which I suppose is good, but we've never gotten to the point where we've had more housing available than the need is. Now, we've always been pretty close, and I don't know where the numbers are now, but I would suspect that we're really pretty close. Or we've got an aging trailer fleet that was worrisome to me 10 years ago, and it's 10 years older now. I think we've got a limited number of apartments and so forth because you got a mix of needs for people who need housing and what people can afford. And when you get into the private homes, we have wonderful builders in town. We have great homes, but they're expensive. And I don't know what the bottom line now is, but I would suspect it's hard to find a house now for less than $300,000 or $400,000. And you know that requires a pretty big income to afford those kind of things. So the housing issue that we've been grappling with for years remains sort of unsolved, I think. And that's not particularly anybody's fault. I think it's a really difficult problem to solve. You got to look at trader options, at low-income housing, affordable housing, which is different than low-income housing. It's just a whole range of things, and we probably have work to do there, Ed. Yeah. Transportation outside the city is also a big thing. I mean, it's if you're a family here, it costs a lot to get in and out of Sitka, so that's another issue. But you get rid of the expense of getting out of Sitka and the housing, I think our cost of living, if the government can stay under control, is pretty reasonable. I mean, we've always taken pride in that we have low utility rates. I mean, well, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. A better thing is to keep them low. You know, it's not just because they're low, let's raise them. And again, I don't think that anybody's being capricious in the assembly about that. But the difficulty is trying to maintain low utility rates across the board because the housing is so expensive. I think our food prices, when we travel, if we get a sun in the West East Coast, it's not that bad, actually. So
not that different than
right.
heading out there. Transportation in and out of Sitka. This seems to be a common refrain in every year of elections I've covered since coming here. Tell me your thoughts on ferry service, and I guess more importantly, since we're talking about an assembly seat, what kinds of things the city can do to bolster people's ability to get to and from this place?
Well, the ferry service, I think, has gotten marginally better in the last 10 years. Although the fast ferries have been unreliable, which is unfortunate. The real solution to our transportation problems in Southeast, and a lot of people really do not want to support this, to hear this. They think it's going to change who we are as a region. But you build a road up the Lynn Canal, and I was in Juneau, Southeast Regional Director, and in the EIS on that, I would ask anybody who, whatever their political biases or preferences are, go look at that and challenge them to find anything that EIS that does not deal with all the environmental impact statements that need to be dealt with up the Lynn Canal. You build the road up the Lynn Canal, you'll just eliminate it. You've done two things. One is you connected our freight system to the National Highway System so you could ship fish cheaper. The second thing that you've done is you've just eliminated a third of the need of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Don't there be a math major to figure out if you got a third less need, you got more assets to deploy south of Juneau to the ferry system. And then the other thing that is certainly controversial and needs to be dealt with publicly and fully, but if you get a road across Baranoff, if you was to do that, if you choose to do that, then you've really in a road from Cake to Petersburg, all of a sudden we're into short stretches of the Marine Highway System where you could move goods and services and people more freely, economically, and so forth. So that's the long-term strategy that would really, really solve the problem. Again, there are a lot of people who have well thought out disagreements with that would challenge that. But, strategically, I think that's where we need to go. So, Southeast transportation and energy are really part of our future that I personally support the Southeast Intertie and a road network that gets us cheaper and daily service throughout the region. So,
there's kind of a blessing and a curse to living on the outside, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, there is. And listen, no, see, one of the, nobody wants, again, what's the standard? Small town atmosphere. Quality. Part of our quality of life is when you look out, this is what you see. And part of our quality of life is that we're a homogeneous community that's a fishing village that's unique and separated, so forth, you know. But you also need to have a economic base that can provide our senior citizens and our kids and everybody else the kind of opportunities that we want to do here. So, you know, my wife and I are tennis players and very few in this town, but it's nice to have tennis courts. It's nice that Deb and I are both physical fitness sort of freaks and we work out at the Hames, and it's nice to have a place where you go the dark and winter and do an hour and a half workout two or three times a week to do that, you know. So, but these things all take capital and a robust, a solid economy for them to happen. So,
we're talking to you now and a little later than we did the rest of the candidates because you've been out of town overseas. Where were you?
Thanks for asking. We went to Israel and then to Egypt, 5 days in Israel, 12 days in Egypt. It was my wife and I are both people of faith. We go to St. Peter's, senior warden there and labor of love. God bless Father Dave Ellison, who just retired, and we're in the process of getting new priests. But anyway, we spent 5 days in Israel, primarily in Jerusalem. We went down to Palestine, to Bethlehem, and saw all the traditional things that you would expect us to see there. And we saw in Palestine, and I was surprised to know this, that Bethlehem is in Palestine. It's a pretty vibrant economy. If you take Palestine versus Gaza, their actual economic growth rate in Palestine is pretty significant. And
you're talking about the West Bank? Or
yeah, the West Bank, yeah. And so that bodes well in terms of, in my view, and I'm, in terms of hopes and dreams of the people in the West Bank, that they see the opportunity of a growing economy to take care of social, political needs, you know, versus other alternatives. Very, very complex area, but we enjoyed our visit there. And then the 12 days in Egypt were exhausting and breathtaking and unbelievable. I mean, the amount of building that the pharaohs did in the 3,000 years before Christ, and most of it done between the 3,000 and 1,500 B.C., and you got to see it to believe it. We all hear about the pyramids and the Sphinx. Like, the Karnak, which I can't even describe to you, is a temple that makes that look pales in comparison to that. I can't even describe it, but it's breathtaking. The history of Egypt and all that they have gone through in the last 5,000 years. And we left both Israel and Egypt with sort of a positive feeling that as much as there is continued turmoil in the region, I think that there is hope in both places, to include, I say, the West Bank. So that's certainly our hope and prayer that that's the case. But they were really a breathtaking things. They're also very, a lot of times you're up at five or six in the morning, and then you go out for two or three or 4 hours in Egypt, and it's, you know, about 100 degrees. And then you come back and rest, and you go out in the afternoon and so forth. We did spend 3 days in Nasser Lake and 3 days in the Nile, you know, traveling and seeing. And the Egyptians, what's amazing is, as they built the Nasser Dam, a lot of the great edifices that they built along the southern part of the Nile have been relocated. And a lot of it's been done, you know, with other Greeks, Italians, Germans have come in and they've taken these huge edifices and chopped them into 5,000 pieces and moved them so that they are located, you know, above water at Nasser Dam, Nasser Lake, and they may have two or three of these edifices within, temples is what they most of them were, within, you know, a click or two of each other, so you could go and see them all. But their commitment to the restoration of their history is breathtaking, and I was impressed with, and again, you're being led by people who are been doing this for 15 years, and they're well educated. They understand their craft of their history of Egypt, but you leave there thinking that there's a lot of really human talent in Egypt, as well as in Israel and West Bank. So it was a big trip for us.
Wow. Of course, Egypt's just had some major political upheaval. Did that impact your trip at all? Was it?
Well, we were the first trip back since then. We went with a thing called Viking Cruises, and we were the first ones there. And yeah, it has. I mean, it's had, you know, the tourism is a major, major economic force for Egypt. And part of the benefit for Egyptians about tourism is high density of people involved. In our cruise ship, that was probably held, I don't know, 70 or 80 passengers, had 60 or 70 crew members, you know, from low skill levels to high skill levels. So it was labor intensive, and they've missed that. And so I'm sure that the country is anxious in both Israel and in Egypt to get the tourism back. And again, I probably have no right to say this, but if you could take half of what the Mubarak government took for themselves and put it back into the country in terms of infrastructure and the economy, if they could form a government that would just do something that simple, it would have a major impact in terms of, I think, the ability of Egyptians to grow their infrastructure and their economy. So that's my hope and prayer.
What a trip.
Yeah, what a trip indeed.